Well, good evening. This is John Murphy. I'm going to be your radio host this evening. I'm a retired deputy fire chief and attorney at law out here in Washington State. And usually we will have Kurt Barone and Chip Comstock and Brad Pinsky, who is off busily doing probably lawyerly things in their respective areas, meetings and all those sorts of things. But tonight you have me, and I think that our show tonight will be somewhat of interest to you all, because we're going to talk about the NFPA 1582 standards a little bit, and then talk about presumptive illnesses, and then a short bit on station design in order to take a look at the health and risk management of issues that we find ourselves in a constant basis and pretty much facing every day with the presumptive illness issues. So there's a famous person that made this statement that says predictable is preventable. And we all know who that is. And then, you know, the predictable in public safety is that we understand the hazardous conditions that we face on a daily basis. And so the question is, how are we addressing those predictable issues in our fire stations, in our daily lives with our health and other issues, safety and training and response safety and those sorts of things. So one of the things that we'll be discussing sort of later on here is the ability or the necessity of the fire department itself to help you protect your health through, you know, various and aggressive programs dealing with healthcare management and training safety and those sorts of things. One of the NFPA standards that we are dealing with when it comes specifically to health and safety is the NFPA 1582 standards. And if for those who are listening to the FDIC Fire Law live broadcast a couple of weeks ago, we had Dave Dotson on our show, and Dave was talking about, and he's an NFPA committee member, was talking about taking a look at some consolidation of the standards. So they're not so many. They're I think, a better read for the user, and they would clarify an issue, I think, clearly where there may be a question about, you know, what does this actually mean? Because he kind of made an interesting observations, and I don't remember what the standards are that he was talking about, but he said that, you know, two different standards had the same language but different meaning. And so, you know, what they're trying to do is eliminate the confusion that may ensue as a result of those differing definitions. But we talked a little bit more on the 1500 standard, which is the safety standard for those of you who are in the know. The safety standard obviously is an important component of what we do, you know, pretty much on a daily basis. So we need to make sure that we understand that our profession is a risky profession. And I, you know, in my experience in 32 years in the fire service, you know, on a daily basis, we tried to do the best we could for the firefighters and to ensure, you know, the health and safety. When I came out in the 70s, the physical exam in our state of Washington adhered to a vertical standard that was created, I think in a combination with OSHA and the State Labor and Industry Division, which put together a fairly comprehensive physical evaluation with x-rays and blood work, electrocardiograms and a physical and those sorts of things. And so, you know, back in those days, they were our best practices in order to ensure that at least we had a firefighter that we came through the door that met the minimum health qualifications. And then over time, we could measure on an annual basis, you know, any changes through annual physicals or biannual physicals and those sorts of things. You know, the NFPA came and been around for a long time, but I think that they added some horsepower to the medical standards that we were trying to accomplish here. And now we're, you know, nationally recognizing that the 1582 standards and the other NFPA standards are generally guidelines. They're great to use in organizations that may not want to adopt them. Because even adopting some of the standards has some jeopardy with fulfilling the standards on, I probably will be tarred and feathered for saying this, but the 1710 standards on staffing, which is a minimum staffing requirement, many departments cannot afford to do that. And so, but it's the goal to strive towards in order to increase, you know, again, the health and safety on the scene of our firefighters. The 1582 standard, I'm working with a company in Texas that does entry-level physicals and annual physicals for not only the fire department, but for other public safety institutions. And, you know, some of the, and I'll, you know, not name names, but the police agencies have a sort of a minimal standard of getting in that you can meet the physical standard as outlined by the hiring department. And, you know, pass a drug test. And so the question is, you know, what is your real standard? And, you know, sort of the prevailing wisdom is that you can take chapters or sections out of the 1582 standard and apply those to public safety officers in pretty much all of the disciplines. As we'll note later on, there is a high mortality rate, both for police and fire. And they're from different causes. So we need to just understand what the health and safety issues are of our industry. Adoption of the standard is not required, right? But we can cherry pick out the best parts. And I think we need to kind of take a look at, do we want to adopt the standard? Because there's an updated chapter in 2022, a new version that came out. And again, every time a new chapter or a version comes out, it becomes a lot more comprehensive as it deals with, again, the health and safety of the firefighter. In the 2022 NFPA 1582 standards, chapter 6 addresses the candidate firefighters. Candidate firefighters are, you know, under increased scrutiny for healthcare issues. There are a lot of exclusions. They're generally listed in a Category A or a Category B. Category A is high risk. Category B is essentially no risk or a minimal risk. And I think that as in a review of that particular standard, they nailed down pretty much all of the healthcare issues that may preclude a firefighter or even a police officer or other public safety officer from entry into a particular discipline. But I think that when I was doing our health and safety for my department, we would have firefighters come in that may have some cardiac issue that needed to be explored. And so we spent the time and the money sending the firefighters for further testing to determine whether this is really an exclusion that they can't come in, or is this a normal variant, which happens many, many times, especially in young, healthy, athletic women that do have some cardiac issue found on an EKG and through, you know, additional testing, find that it's a normal variant for that class of employee. So we don't want to dissuade or discourage or turn down perfectly healthy, qualified candidates because of, you know, an erroneous reading on electrocardiogram, which, one provider reads it one way, and then a specialist provider reads it the other way in favor of the candidate firefighter. The other part is the psychological aspect, and I always recommend that the departments add a psychological evaluation of the firefighter. Sometimes we have people that are just not fit for service on a psychological basis. My wife could probably tell you, Dr. Beth Murphy, who is a psychologist, can tell you what the sort of the disclaimers are and what the issues are based on pre-hire testing. But I think, you know, the psychological testing for those candidates that are successful in getting in can be used as a baseline for further testing of the firefighter as they proceed in their career. And certainly mental health and behavioral health is an important component of what we do and what we should be monitoring for our employees as they progress through their career. The 1582 also has the firefighter incumbent standard. That's generally in Chapter 7, Occupational Evaluation. Chapter 8 is the Annual Occupation Fitness for Members. And then Chapter 9 is the Essential Job Tasks. And many times when firefighters come in for an annual physical or biannual physical, I always ask what their jobs are. What do you do? And they go, well, we do this and that and the other thing. I said, well, does your department actually have an essential job list? They go, well, not really. And so because I've been in the service, I understand it. I do physicals on firefighters and police officers. I understand their job. So, you know, the physical that is tailored specifically to them includes those risk factors that are found in your essential job tasks. But I think for departments that may not have that sort of advanced system or a provider that understands what we do for a living would do well to have what the essential job tasks are for your organization. It's very important that when you're having an injured firefighter returning to work and they're being tested that they can actually do the job after an injury or a surgery or a prolonged illness. They, you know, whoever the evaluating provider is, has got to know what the essential job tasks are and what the firefighter or police officer or EMT does for a living so they can, you know, test to a particular standard. So that's incumbent on you as the employer. And so I think, you know, and take a look at Chapter 9 in the 1582 standard, because there are a list of essential job tasks that do what firefighters, that outline what firefighters do for a living. I want to kind of circle back on the behavioral health issue. Found in Chapter 7 is the behavioral health section. It's very important in today's fire environment and police environment that we, basically do a check-in on an annual basis to see how your employees are doing on the psychological aspect because of all of the issues that have been going on, not only on the job, but in society itself, where, you know, the accumulation of stress is not only job derived, but people have lives, right? So people have families, they have bills, they have, you know, sickness in their parents. There's lots of things going on. Which, you know, is in this accumulative stress environment. So I think, and the other thing is that there's an increase, an uptick in suicide. And so if you take a look at some of Jeff Dill's statistics, a couple of years ago, suicide actually exceeded line of duty deaths for firefighters. And that's just something that we can manage, we can control, but we have to be aware of it, first of all, and then we have to do something about it. With proactive programs in your organizations. There's a number of programs now that are putting behavioral health services in their occupational health centers. Seattle just started a new program. Phoenix has a program. Boise, Idaho has a program. And there are probably more programs down south in California and Oregon and hopefully on the East Coast, but behavioral health is a really important thing for our firefighters, and also implementing a peer support group, an active chaplaincy group, and all of that sort of support that we can do. There's models all over the country that you can, you know, borrow from. People are more than willing to share that information. And those starting some of those programs is pretty low dough. And so you're not expending an extraordinary amount of money to have a program that would save maybe one or two lives in your organization. For firefighters, injuries and deaths for last year, and you hate to kind of go through this, but the information was derived from the FEMA website, a summary of incident report. In 2021, there's 141 on-duty firefighter deaths, 63 due to COVID. And then of the non-COVID deaths, it's the, sort of the usual culprits of cardiac issues, stress, strokes, and then the sort of the ones that we see is the uncontrolled diabetic or the obese firefighter who does have a stroke or a cardiac arrest. So those are essentially correctable, discoverable issues, healthcare issues for the firefighters. And it's, again, incumbent on us as employers and us as leaders and advisors to say, you know, there is something we can do now that would help prevent our firefighter Jones or Murphy from having a cardiac event or a stroke, you know, 10 years down the road if we do something today. Other reasons why firefighter die is vehicle-related incidents, either in the driving arena. We had five airplane crashes last year, and a good friend of mine, Jeff Pachura, who was the retired fire chief in Arizona, died in one as a in a wildland environment where he was in aircraft spotting and the plane crashed and he passed. Tragedy for everyone, certainly. And then there is one firefighter that was struck by a vehicle who passed away as a result of that. And then again, that's a safety issue on the roads. Make sure we create the safety bubble using our apparatus or police apparatus or blockers. And there's innumerable number of pictures in our journals where we do set up the bubble and people still run into us, right? And so we do still get injured. We try to cut the fatality rate down, but sometimes, you know, the people in their vehicles will die as a result of crashing into our blocker vehicles. Police officers, the fatality rate is like phenomenal. Just when I was doing the research on this article, it was like an eye popper as far as the number of police officers who passed in the line of duty was 458 police officers from the federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement died in 2021. Texas had the most. They had 84 line of duty deaths. And then preliminary data from the source that I was using showed that 301 officers died from COVID. And so again, even though the COVID vaccine and the whole masking thing has been highly politicized, the statistics are very telling. And so, I'm a vaccine advocate as a healthcare provider and as a lawyer. I wear a lot of different hats. And I know that some of our firefighters here in my department have been released from duty for declining receiving the COVID vaccine. But again, we know that it works. It's very effective. It has very few side effects. And I'm not here to promote it. I'm here to encourage you to think about if you don't have it, to get it because it's been proven. And we have met the 1 million dead American threshold last week from COVID. So we're trying not to be a statistic, excuse me, and try to do the best thing you can for yourself and your families. 58 police officers died in motor vehicle accidents or traffic related issues. And then a bunch of them, died from assaults and gunshot wounds. And then of the non-COVID and non-traumatic injuries to police officers, they had 25 officers who died in the line of duty from health related issues. With cardiac disease, strokes, a few died from 9/11 incidents, and as did a few of the firefighters as well. But the general toll of police and fire officers is staggering in our country, and we can do something about some of it, We can't do a lot about a lot of it. So I think it's incumbent again on us as leaders, managers, supervisors, chief officers, elected officials, to take a look at the risk that our firefighters and police officers and EMTs face, and then do the predictable as preventable. We understand what the predictable is, and we can do a lot in order to prevent. One of the things that I know as an attorney, I've been called to consult on or return to work after illness or injury issues where the fire chief or the whoever the powers to be won't allow a firefighter to come back to work because of a medical condition that they went out with that is precluded under the Chapter 6 standard of the NFPA 1582. Remember, Chapter 6 is for incumbent firefighters, for candidate firefighters, and incumbent firefighters are found in the additional chapters. So lots of examples of return to work injuries that may involve a loss of a limb or a vision loss, a hearing loss, head trauma. And I think that there's probably more head trauma in the fire service than is reported, creating concussions and some traumatic brain injuries, affecting firefighters' performance and lots of other things that go along with neurologic injuries. And so, again, it's very important that the department has a job analysis and what does the firefighter do when and if they can come back to work. So the question is, can the employee do the essential elements of the job? And then the employers need to do a return to work program. There's some issues about having to create a light duty program in your organization. And I think the prevailing wisdom is if you don't have a light duty position in your organization and never had a light duty position in your organization, you don't necessarily have to create one for this particular employee. However, if you've had a light duty position, then you have to make the accommodation or the reasonable accommodation in order to bring that person back in a light duty position for a period of time, not a lifetime, but for a reasonable period of time so the firefighter or the police officer or the EMT can heal and then get ready to return to work. Again, the lawyer hat is clicked on here, and sometimes denying these firefighters coming back, you may violate an ADA rule if you return a disabled individual who can actually do the job after an independent medical exam evaluation or some other evaluation indicating that even though they may be missing a finger or a limb, with proper prostheses and other devices, they can do the job. You may be charged with an ADA violation, which would be brought by the disabled firefighter that you don't return to work, and you may find yourself again in a courtroom where it would be better to just to create the program, have the person be evaluated by an outside specialist, do your own internal evaluations, and then return to work, the firefighter work if they can do the job. Excuse me. I don't have COVID, so we're good. The one of the big issues is sometimes, firefighters just cannot, or they are unable to come back to work after an injury or an illness. And again, it's incumbent on the department to create a pathway for the individuals, either if there's capacity in the organization or in the community, that they can do another non-firefighter job if that's possible, or create a pathway for disability through the disability board or through your state labor industries disability programs in order for that firefighter to retire out with a disability. And that's a whole other chapter that I know that Kurt Barone and his partners can do, but I'm not going to go down that rat hole tonight anyway. So we're in the prevention business, right? So we try to prevent fires and emergencies from occurring in our organization. But again, we need to think about, the prevention considerations in our own organization. So we need to identify those risks and how we mitigate those risks. And, we're collectively we're pretty smart as a group. And I know that there's a lot of horsepower in an organization with a lot of brains that can put together a fairly comprehensive analysis of what we do and how we can think about our firefighters as some people say, as industrial athletes, which we are. You know, we're industrial elite athletes and need to be sort of managed that way, especially when it comes to the health and the nutrition. And there's a lot of material out there that talks about, you know, fitness on duty, fitness off duty, and the nutritional things that we probably don't do but should do by eating healthy in the station. Officer safety with situational awareness. And I know that Rich Gassaway has a great program on situational awareness, and he teaches that a lot of places around the world to various institutions, and notwithstanding the fire service. And we're trying to prevent this, you know, the officer down or mayday calls through good comprehensive training with our firefighters when they enter the hostile environments, and trying to you know, get the safety nexus in their minds that, you know, sometimes you don't enter a hazardous condition until there's enough resources to do so. And I know that our firefighters are young and hard charging. They want to go, you know, full bore into a situation, but I think we need to, through experience, and the older firefighters need to restrain, you know, this sort of eager enthusiasm in our group. One of the issues is the wildland firefighting. We did talk about that a little bit with Dave Dotson and the arduous conditions and that they have to do their pack tests and those sorts of things. And for those of you who are wildland firefighters, there's a whole standard for y'all under the NFPA. And I know that in our organization, we started 2 wildland firefighting teams many years ago, and they have been deployed all over the western states. And I think they even went to Alaska for a fire up there. And those are arduous and hazardous conditions. And I think that if you do have a wildland fire team or more, you know, certainly proper outfitting, proper health and fitness, proper tools, proper training, all of those sorts of things should be foremost in your mind, because we've noticed over the last couple of weeks, there have been at least 2 wildland firefighters who have perished in the pursuit of their duties as well. Rehabilitation on injuries. There's lots of different programs through a work hardening program or physical therapy or occupational therapy or chiropractic practices are available for us, again, in the world. And we, again, need to take advantage of those programs. And then I can't reinforce the need for annual medical physicals that your department can very easily do utilizing hire an organization that does annual medical physicals for fire and police officers and incorporate their services as well. Kind of switching hats, we're going to talk a little bit here about presumptive illnesses. And many states have presumptive health laws protecting firefighters and EMTs and police officers. And certainly our state, the state of Washington, has one. Cancers are the ones that are the most presumptive of the presumptive illnesses, such as rectal cancer, skin cancer, prostate, testicle cancer, brain, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and there's several other ones. And in some states, women are basically left out with breast cancer or ovarian cancer, but other states have included women's cancers into the presumptive arena, and I think that's very important. Every presumptive case requires a claimant to file the claim and provide medical evidence their disease was obtained while on the job. Proving the disease was acquired on the job is documentation and record keeping, right? And so, and the presumptive aspect of a presumptive illness is that it's up to your employer to challenge the presumption. So you say, that seems like a crazy thing to say, but you say, I got skin cancer or throat cancer or bladder cancer while on the job. The department or labor and industries or whoever provides your third-party healthcare coverage can't just say, no, it's not a presumptive illness, because under the law, it's clearly defined that, you know, those types of cancers and more are covered. What they need to prove is that you did not obtain that on the job, that you obtained that from some other source that was not job related. And I can tell you that from the experiences that I've had with a couple of clients, it's an uphill climb and a battle which boils down to the experts on both sides of whether I contracted skin cancer, as an example, on the job, or, you know, because I have red hair and fair skin and I'm freckled and I spend a lot of time in the sun, you know, the melanoma, for example, I got was sun-induced and not occupationally induced. So you need to make sure that if you're exposed to any sort of chemicals or toxins or any of that sort of stuff out on the fire ground, then you need to report it, right? Or you need to document it. And I know that seems to be, you know, like, oh my God, you know, 20 years from now, I'm not even going to worry about it. But 20 years from now is when a lot of these cancers occur. And it's good to have that documentation early on when you're exposed to it to make sure that you at least have medical documentation, you know. So after you get challenged by the city or your municipality saying, no, this is not on the job acquired, then again, you know, then we get into the litigation, the lawsuits, the court battles and those sorts of things in order to prove that your claim is a legitimate on the job claim. I think that the other, there's a couple of cases. One is in Oregon, one of the firefighters had suffered cardiac arrest, was successfully resuscitated. Evaluation showed that she didn't have any sort of cardiac damage. It was more of an electrical conduction problem. And so her cardiologist put an implantable defibrillator in her and she wanted to return back to work. And the employer declined her return to work. And so she sued based on that they were discriminating against her. The research would indicate that employees with an ICD or an implantable cardiac defibrillator can do arduous work. The research shows that if there is an event and the cardiac defibrillator activates, for those who have had that happen to them, it's just sort of a hiccup, I guess they describe it. And it's like, oh my gosh, my defibrillator just activated. But it doesn't certainly incapacitate them. And the experience so far is that, people, especially in our profession, can work certainly with certain testing to return back to work, that they can be very productive, you know, pretty much for the rest of their work career. So she filed a lawsuit, she wins the lawsuit, and she also files a lawsuit against the Department for Discrimination. They basically retaliated against her for filing a worker comp claim and several other issues. So the fire departments need to be prepared for these events and don't react adversely, but sort of think through the problem that, you know, certainly this person is in an arduous occupation. There can be cardiac events and certainly cancers that are produced from exposures that we're exposed to. And the departments need to pre-think or predict how they're going to respond to these sort of presumptive illness disability claims. So think forward, don't think, in reverse or that sort of stuff. The other sort of the third leg of this whole thing, other than the presumptive illness, is fire station design. And then we're becoming smarter, I think, in designing our fire station. So firefighters do spend a third of their lives in stations. I think it's incumbent, or it is incumbent, on the elected officials and chief officers when they build remodel a fire station to think about health and safety of the firefighters. Now, one of the presumptive illnesses is cancers. And so we're exposed to carcinogens all the time. And a lot of it comes actually from our diesels when they're fired up in the fire station and without a good air management system in there or exhaust recovery program in your organization, the diesel carcinogens particulate matter spews out onto bunker clothing. That is, you know, we have a tendency to store it on the apparatus bay. And so then we put that all on, or you know, we don't decontaminate sufficiently after a fire, so we're carrying these carcinogens around. And so fire stations need to be designed with those sort of mechanisms in place. Some, you know, forward-thinking architects and designers are taking a look at, you know, separating the apparatus bay floor from the living quarters through, you know, airlock systems or a pressure system that separates the atmospheres. They're putting in washer extractors so you can wash your bunker clothing while you're on duty. They're incorporating a, you know, regular household laundry machines and dryers in the fire station so you can wash your uniforms, don't have to take them home and cross-contaminate your family's laundry. They're taking a look at decon stations for your SCBA apparatus. They're taking a look at decon showers in the fire stations that are separate from, you know, the regular living quarter showers that we're so used to. So even in a remodel, which I think we're going to be seeing more and more of this sort of separation concept, and especially in new buildings, the standard is changing rapidly. That does drive up costs in the long run, but in the longer run, it saves, I think, a lot of contamination and cancers that we would find affecting our firefighters while they're on the job. And living in a fire station, which generally is their home for at least a third of the year, I know that, you know, money is always an issue, and I think it's, you know, incumbent that fire departments go after every grant they could possibly have or any sort of funding source that's out there and available for fire station remodel or new design, because in the long run, you're going to save many of your firefighters some long-term disease and illnesses. The last part of this is make sure you have adequate policies in place, so firefighters will take advantage of these sort of benefits that they have, because we're sort of a stubborn bunch, and you know, we kind of have a mindset that we're bulletproof when we're younger. You'll find out that when you're older in your 50s and 60s that bulletproofing in the 20s doesn't certainly pay off when you're 50 and 60 years old. So prevention is the best, right? Prevention is the best possible method of you know, living long and prospering. And what my plan is to outlive my pension contributions. And so far I'm doing pretty good. So I think you just need to understand the concept that Gordon Graham says is predictable is preventable. And we know what the prediction is. We've lived in the industry for a long period of time. We understood the effects of, you know, bad policies or no policies. We've understood the effects of, you know, dirty bunker gear and a black helmet is salty in the fire service. But today, the saltiness should wear off pretty rapidly. And you need to make sure that you keep your bunker clothing and your helmets and your gear and yourself as clean as possible. So that's pretty much it for now. If there's any questions, you know, please feel free to call any one of us, Kurt Verone, who has a very active website, Chip Comstock, Brad Pinsky, or myself. You're more than welcome to contact us either by phone or email, and that we will be more than happy to respond to your inquiries. And I always tell people if I, you know, advice over the phone is free, but you have to remember how valuable free advice is. I never charge for phone advice, but if I actually have to do something on the legal side, then you're going to get a bill. But I'm always here, like as my cohorts are as well, that we'd be more than happy to talk to you on the phone, maybe answer a question. And if we don't know what the answer is, then we'll find somebody that can help you and we'll answer your questions. All right, without further ado, I appreciate you spending your 40 minutes with me and talking about the 1582 standard, presumptive illness, fire station design, and all the good things that make the fire service such a wonderful place to be. So be safe out there, and until next month, we'll talk to you then. Good night.